As drones proliferate and become more sophisticated, what questions does this raise in the international arena? Do drones present challenges we've never faced before? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day here on the program. And this hour, we cast our analysis to the world outside our borders and take a look at how new technology, drones, cyber attacks are shaping international politics. Also, updates on Syria, Iran, North Korea, and Afghanistan. Our analysts, Lindsay Kahn of the University of Northern Iowa, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. International politics, attack of the drones, after this news. It's Politics Day here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're going to look at how new technology, drones, cyber attacks are shaping international politics. Also, a little later in the hour, updates on Syria, Iran, North Korea, and Afghanistan. Our analysts this week, they specialize in international politics. We have with us Jim McCormick, professor and chair of the Iowa State University Department of Political Science in our Ames studio. Hi, Jim.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. And to the north, we have Lindsay Kahn with us, assistant professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls, in our Cedar Falls studio. Lindsay Kahn, welcome back.
Hi, Ben.
Well, let's start off to mix politics, not with religion, but with technology this first hour, starting off by talking about drones a bit. Last week, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul began the first filibuster of the session, withdrawing after 12 or 13 hours. He filibustered President Obama's nominee for the director of the CIA, John Brennan, and that was in response to what he considers ambiguity in the administration's policy on domestic drone strikes.
When the president responds that I haven't killed any Americans yet at home and that I don't intend to do so, but I might, it's incredibly alarming and really goes against his oath of office.
Rand Paul vowed to keep talking until the White House clarified whether it has the authority to kill U.S. citizens on American soil with drones. Administration of lawyers said in all but the most extreme cases, the answer is no. Finally, Paul ended his filibuster. But this debate over drones is not over. And I hope you'll agree with me, Jim and Lindsay, that people are talking about drones because though there were some way out ideas in Rand Paul's filibuster, it got us to think about, got me to think specifically about the future of drones. So I wonder if I can throw this out, first of all, for both of you to offer your insights on. As the drones proliferate and become more and more sophisticated, what questions does this pose to the international community among relations among countries? Lindsay Kahn.
Well, there are sort of two main uses for drones. One, of course, is what Senator Paul was talking about, I'm sorry, what Rand Paul was talking about, which is targeted strikes, actually killing people. The other one is surveillance, and different sets of rules would cover these two types of activities, both domestically and internationally. So I think, you know, we have to sort of, anytime you're talking about law, the answer is always it depends. I mean, you can't talk about the whole class of things being obviously illegal. It always depends on the circumstances. You must apply law to the circumstances. So I think these are both very complex conversations. They do need to be talked about, absolutely, and we need to clarify sort of the rules under which we want to function. And I think it's important for the U.S. to clarify the rules under which we think drones ought to be used for both of these purposes for international rule purposes. But that being said, you know, drones are not somehow immune from the rules that already exist. A lot of people seem to be worried that this new technology somehow circumvents all of the existing rules of international law. That's not the case. You can't fly into somebody's airspace without permission, for example. You know, you can't do certain things with a drone any more than you could with a manned aircraft or a missile.
Mm-hmm. I wondered, Jim McCormick, does this, the coming of the drones, raise any challenges and present any concerns that we've never had to face before?
It's a new technology in terms of the conduct of war here. at least to more sophisticated technology. And it does, I think, Lindsay's absolutely right, in terms of thinking about American policy, because up to this juncture, it's not clear. I mean, this is what this debate is about, and particularly when the president, or at least the Department of Justice, had this white paper, which was released about a month ago, or at least sort of leaked, I guess, to NBC News about a month ago, you know, raising this whole question that the president could, actually kill American citizens if he decided that they were, part of al-Qaeda or a senior, quote the language, a senior operational leader. So I do think it raises this whole question of accountability here. And the accountability not only within the country, but as Lindsay was saying, you really have to also, if you're going to use this technology, coordinate it with other countries. For example, we've used them in Pakistan. Not always. I mean, obviously, we've got sort of kind of a sotto voce agreement with Pakistan to let us to do this. But sometimes the public statements by Pakistani leaders have been very opposite. So there, it seems to me, there's an accountability at home. There's an accountability abroad. I think the other big issue with this kind of technology is sort of the blowback. We're already getting some of that, but that's going to really increase too. And that is, how are other countries going to react to this? And then how many other countries? I mean, I saw this one account saying that 50 countries and, that drones are now on display at the Paris Air Show. You know, Iran claims they shot down a drone and so on and want to replicate the American technology, or at least that's what they sort of publicly stated. So there's this whole expansion of the drone phenomenon as well.
Mm-hmm. River to River listeners, what are your questions, your comments about how drone technology, cybersecurity affecting U.S. relations with other countries? What do you see in the future? Does it worry you? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. I wonder, in thinking about this, the U.S. is the one connected with drones now. We have the drone technology. But I wonder, Lindsay Kahn, if we might be living in a time in some ways comparable to 1945 through 1949, when the U.S. had the nuclear bomb, had an atomic bomb. The Soviet Union did not. Will, as Jim just so alluded to, other countries catch up with this, and then we'll have every country with its fleet of drones?
Well, first of all, I would seriously hesitate to compare the type of technology that a drone is to the type of leap forward that an atomic bomb was. I don't think that drone technology has the same effect on international peace and security that the emergence of an atomic bomb did. I think those are two just very, very not two things that I would want to compare to one another. That being said, is there going to be a sort of drone arms race? Yeah, probably. I mean, they're very cheap. The same way that there's been an arms race with tanks and anti-tank weaponry and submarines and anti-submarine technology, this is a technology. There will be an arms race of some kind. They're much cheaper than manned aircraft. They're certainly cheaper than a space program. But that being said, they're also really easy to shoot down. Mm-hmm. So I would hesitate to call this, a really huge game changer in terms of the way that combat will be conducted. For surveillance purposes, they could be really useful. The real thing in my mind that makes drones interesting in terms of changing the way people do things is because they change the cost-benefit analysis in many ways. They don't change sort of the basic capabilities that anybody has, but they make certain capabilities much cheaper, which makes it easier to choose to do something that you might not have chosen to do had you not had that cheap capability. And so in that sense, you could see issues of escalation happening where somebody, might not have chosen to do some kind of surveillance before, but if they have a cheap drone, they might try to do it, and then somebody gets angry and shoots it down, and then you've got an escalation situation. But in general, I don't think that we're likely to see sort of drone wars. I don't think you're going to see fleets of drones going out against each other. I think that that's all sort of overblown.
Also, another aspect of this is drones can be shrunken down into insect size things. I watched a DOD video just yesterday about this. I think they're called micro air vehicles. So you had a larger drone flying over a country, dropping maybe 100 beetle-sized drones into a city for surveillance, but also lethal possibilities with those small drones. The blowback you mentioned, Jim McCormick, go into that a little bit more, because this is not without a cost when we take out people suspected in other countries in Pakistan, right?
Yes. I mean, we've seen the escalation of drone usage here by the Obama administration compared to the Bush administration, because I think partly just to add on a little bit what Lindsay was saying about the cost, the costs of war or costs of this kind of conflict seems to have de-escalated. I mean, because the public doesn't really see this. But in fact, there are civilian casualties associated with these drones. And that's what I was really getting back in terms of the blowback, because even as we might try to, if you will, win the hearts and minds, say, in Afghanistan or Pakistan, if there are civilian casualties associated with this kind of new military technology, eliminated the kind of sort of soft power efforts that we're undertaking here. There was an interesting study, and I just picked it up and brought it with me today, by the Council on Foreign Relations, a person who looked at this. You know, there's no real accurate count of the drone strikes. I mean, because obviously these are classified operations and so on. But there are various groups and organizations that have done this, and you know, the numbers that they talk about in terms of the number of people killed, you know, and the number of these strikes in the hundreds here that have occurred over the last several 4 or 5 years are some of the data that they have, and then the civilian casualties that emanate from this. You know, they're obviously raising this whole question, and this kind of study is raising this question of what kind of accountability are you going to have in terms of these operations. Now, I personally believe that there is obviously a much more caution and much more kind of control than maybe just spewing out some of these figures suggest. And there's a sensitivity to this. But I think this is what, in some ways, in my view, the Congress probably has to take up, and the president has to come forward with some kind of a more clearly stated policy.
Let's go quickly before our break to a related technological development, cybersecurity. In his State of the Union address last month, President Obama mentioned cyber attacks as a growing concern for U.S. security.
America must also face the rapidly growing threat from cyber attacks. Now, we know hackers steal people's identities and infiltrate private emails. We know foreign countries and companies swipe our corporate secrets. Now our enemies are also seeking the ability to sabotage our power grid, our financial institutions, our air traffic control systems. We cannot look back years from now and wonder why we did nothing in the face of real threats to our security and our economy. And that's why earlier today, I signed a new executive order that will strengthen our cyber defenses by increasing information sharing and developing standards to protect our national security, our jobs, and our privacy.
President Obama during the State of the Union address last month. A month later, now cyber attacks still in the forefront of security talks in Washington. At a hearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday, cyber attacks were noted as a top threat to U.S. security. Lindsey Kahn, I wonder, when we talk about cybersecurity and threats, it's all about, I guess, information. Is this simply an extension of sort of spying between countries, whether it be industrial spying, that also in there, that has gone on for centuries, or does it have a qualitative difference, you think?
Well, there is somewhat of, obviously there are similarities in terms of simply obtaining information, and certainly espionage sometimes extended to extending misinformation. But in terms of cyber attacks, you are talking about a qualitative difference insofar as cyber attacks can actually alter the activity of some of these systems that you're talking about. So instead of simply hacking into them and stealing information, which is one thing that you can do, you can hack in and actually, you know, shut things down or change them entirely, make them do something totally different from what they were doing before. And that is far more proactive than most espionage was. I do want to point out, though, that cybersecurity is inherently difficult. You are always playing catch-up because the people who are doing cyber attacks are the creative side, right? It's very difficult to defend against something that somebody hasn't come up with yet. And every time you come up with a defense, they will be the creative side trying to get around it. So it's an inherently difficult form of catch-up.
Lindsey Conn with us, Jim McCormick with us as well. We'll come back in just a few minutes, leaving with this Facebook post from Leslie, one of our listeners. Drone warfare in the U.S. is the U.S.'s current version of Ender's Game, a science fiction novel about intergalactic warfare. She writes, drones have not reduced killing. By killing innocent people, drone attacks have aggravated grievances with our country. What's your opinion as we discuss politics and technology? Also to come in this second half hour, updates on Syria, Iran, North Korea, and Afghanistan. We'll try to get to all of those with updates from Lindsey Conn and Jim McCormick, our political analysts this week. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday here. We're casting our gaze internationally with Lindsey Conn, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Jim McCormick, Professor and Chair of ISU's Department of Political Science. We invite you to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100 this half hour. On our docket, Syria, Iran, North Korea, Afghanistan, hotspots in the world, U.S. relations, U.S. actions in those areas. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or post something on our Facebook page. Let's start with Syria, if we could, Jim and Lindsey. The civil war continuing in Syria. Some analysts seeing those signs of a subtle shift in U.S. efforts to end that war. Secretary of State John Kerry's Gulf tour last week, he spoke in Saudi Arabia. He said the U.S. would work to bring about a peaceful resolution, but is still against sending weapons to the opposition due to concern about radical Islamists fighting beside moderate rebels.
The United States will continue to work with our friends, as we did in Rome, to empower the Syrian opposition to be able to hopefully bring about a peaceful resolution. There is no guarantee that one weapon or another might not at some point in time fall into the wrong hands.
Secretary of State John Kerry. Lindsey Conn, I guess he's referring to past U.S. experience with the Mujahideen.
To a certain extent, yes. He's also referring to the al-Nusra Front, which is a group that is fighting in Syria on the rebel side right now, that the U.S. government has designated a terrorist organization. They've designated that as a sort of alias for al-Qaeda in Iraq, and it's actually U.S. law that we can't provide weapons to them, so that would be awkward. And another issue that he's worried about, of course, is the fact that the United Nations has sent out a report now that both sides in the Syrian war have committed atrocities, are using children, for example, using human shields, using indiscriminate weapons, things like that. So the U.S. has a specific concern in terms of providing lethal aid to a group that includes people we have recognized as terrorists, although we recognize that, we claim that the al-Nusra Front is fighting this battle for its own purposes, that they are a different and distinct group from the original Syrian rebels who were fighting for their own freedom and ideals. We certainly recognize that. But we do have significant concerns about who would have these weapons and where they would end up and what they would be used to do.
Jim McCormick.
It's significant that Secretary Kerry, though, did say that the United States was going to go ahead with $60 million in non-lethal assistance. And, funds become fungible for these various groups here. And it's not insignificant that he was in Saudi Arabia, who apparently, at least from my understanding, has been aiding the opposition in Syria, that this you know, the United States really, I think, has, in that sense, really ratcheted up the effort there.
That's absolutely true. You know, both Qatar and Saudi Arabia have been supplying weapons to the Syrian rebels, and we are aware of that. We have been actually aiding their efforts. We simply have not provided any lethal aid because, Ben, as you pointed out, you know, we've been bitten several times by providing weapons and then having, you know, having people show up. Everybody has seen Argo at this point. There's the one line of the man in the bazaar who says, "My son was shot by the Shah with an American gun."
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, why do you think this shift has taken place now under Secretary Kerry's first weeks in office?
Well, I think, you know, he did, as part of his tour here, you know, he went to the Europe and Middle East, not to Asia here. And I think he's really signaling, you know, that this is an important dimension for the Obama administration in the second term. I mean, the Middle East has been such a cauldron in terms of getting any movement for the administration in the first term. I think that ratcheting it up now is significant. The other obvious reason is that now the numbers keep rising, and 70,000 you know, are the totals. I don't know if those totals are accurate, but even if there's a margin of error here, the number of people killed in the civil war is just wholly unacceptable to the international community.
Lindsey Khan, you mentioned Iran, Syria not bordering, sharing a border with Iran, Iraq between Syria and Iran. But there is a role of Iran, a significant key player here. Iran, remind us of that.
Very much so. Iran, of course, is a direct backer of the Syrian government. The Syrian government is made up of Alawites, which is a sect of Shiism. Of course, Iran also a Shiite state, and they have a common interest there in being opposed to a number of Sunni-run states in between them and surrounding them. Iran also a backer of Hezbollah, which is also backing Syria. So Iran, both a direct and indirect supporter of the Syrian government. And Iran has a very, very large stake in not allowing Syria to become a Sunni-run state. So Iran, unlike Russia, has a sort of direct interest in making sure that this turns out a certain way. You know, Russia has been backing the Assad regime up until now, and they're still backing him to a certain extent, but Russia could be peeled off, possibly. I think, you know, what Jim pointed out is very important, but also I would point out that things on the ground have changed as well. The rebels have gained territory, which means that revisiting the concept of humanitarian corridors and refugee safe havens would be, I think, a good idea at this point. It would be more feasible now than it was when the idea was first broached. We had been providing non-lethal aid to the Syrians already, but never directly to the rebels. And so this really is a shift in the sense that, as Jim points out, you know, if they don't have to spend money on food and medical supplies, they can spend that money on other things. And that, so it's fungible in that sense. So we really are shifting support behind them. But I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the situation on the ground is changing and making it look more like we could really shape the outcome.
I don't think we should be too naive about that there's not a covert operation going on here. I mean, there's been leaked information that the United States is working with Jordan on a covert operation in terms of on the armed side here. I you know, with Turkey, of course, it's mostly been non-lethal efforts here in terms of this kind of safe, trying to create safe havens and so on. But I would be very stunned if there were not a covert finding that has been signed by the president to provide assistance.
Let's put our focus squarely on Iran, a different issue, the international effort to stop Iran's nuclear program, said to be entering a critical phase. Yesterday, Secretary of State Kerry sat down with NBC's Andrea Mitchell in Doha and commented on how the administration is dealing with Iran's emerging nuclear program.
Everybody has made it clear there cannot be negotiations for the sake of it. This is not an infinite process. It's finite. Our preference, President Obama's preference, clearly stated, is to ask the Iranians to come to the table in good faith, in mutual respect, and do what they say they're doing.
Can we trust them?
Which is proved. No, this is not a matter of trust, Andrea. You remember Gorbachev and trust but verify. This is a matter of creating an agreement, if it's possible, where it is verifiable as to what they are doing, so that everybody, the international community, the United Nations, Israel, our friends, our allies, all can come together and know what is happening. If that can't happen, then obviously there are other choices available to the president, and he has taken nothing off the table.
John Kerry yesterday on NBC. At the hearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday, there was a debate over whether sanctions on Iran are an effective deterrent. Arguments went back and forth between James Clapper, he's the U.S. Director of National Intelligence, and Susan Margaret Collins, a senior United States senator from Maine. Let's listen to a bit of that.
The sanctions are having a huge impact, and I think clearly that is going to have an influence on their decision-making calculus, and we see indications of that. But where I do agree, it is the sanctions thus far have not induced a change in Iranian government policy.
Well, I think the fact that they haven't produced a change suggests that General Mattis is correct in saying that they're not working.
Okay. Lindsey Kahn, can I have you describe where you think we are in this ongoing effort, international effort, to stop Iran's nuclear program?
Oh.
maybe limited comment what you just heard there.
Well, okay. So as far as sanctions go, I would like to point out that they're sort of both right in the sense that we've had sanctions on Iran ever since the revolution. Many countries have had sanctions on Iran for a long, long time. And, of course, we've been ratcheting up the sanctions since the discovery of their nuclear program, their nuclear power program. Have the sanctions actually made them change any of their policies? No, they haven't. Not a single Iranian policy has changed as a result of the sanctions. Have the sanctions affected their behavior and their cost-benefit analyses and sort of their calculation as to the situation? Yeah, I think so. It would not make any sense to unilaterally remove the sanctions. But I do think that it will make sense. It would make a lot of sense if we would finally acknowledge, you know, if we would sit down and figure out exactly why Iran wants nuclear breakout capability, because it's not, you know, it's not entirely clear that they are, in fact, trying to build a bomb right now. Why would they want it? And can we address that in any way that would be, you know, in our own interests? I would suggest basically that they might have legitimate security concerns in the region. You know, they certainly want to be a leading power in the region. They want prestige. But they also have security concerns. They are surrounded by states that are U.S. allies, and they would like to have sort of the ultimate deterrent. If we can somehow find a way to address those concerns and address those issues, I think they'd be, you know, they might be willing to stop enriching. They might be willing to allow inspectors. That's not a guarantee.
Right. Jim McCormick, do you agree with that assessment? Really getting at that question, the nugget of why they are pursuing nuclear weapons?
Well, I just think the other equation I just noted as Lindsey was talking, you know, is the question of Israel here and the Israel's perceived security in the region as well, which is, part of the American position that they've said they will not accept Iranian nuclear weaponry here. We've had 8 rounds of sanctions. I just sort of did a quick count on this since 2006 by the United Nations, and then, of course, the EU going into effect last July, and the United States, as Lindsey pointed out, actually back to 1979 or 1980 after the Iranian Revolution here. And so those things have not really, really worked. I mean, I think it's a combination of not only deterrence, but I think it's also a combination of prestige. They also see, much as the North Koreans, frankly, they see even engaging in this as a real bargaining chip with other states in the region and with the larger powers. So I think it's really a combination of factors that motivates. The other thing that I'm a little bit skeptical about whether any real progress is going to be done at this juncture is, you know, there are elections coming up in Iran here in the summertime. I'm not sure, you know, that the religious leaders will really change their position, but maybe if the election outcomes are not, you know, are a little bit more convoluted than we might think, maybe that would move them in a direction. But I wouldn't see any movement until those elections are really held.
What can we see? What do you two see as possible outcomes
of the election?
Of this entire showdown over Iran's nuclear program.
Well, I'll take a crack at that first. I think what what we can really hope for is that we can really extend the time frame of when they'll move beyond the 20%. I mean, the bargaining positions right now, or at least the offer on the table, is to stop the enrichment of uranium, you know, from 20% at 20% and move that to in some neutral area and so on. Really, to enrich uranium for really weapons grade, you got to get up to about 90% here, and I mean that. It's not just a linear development. Apparently, it's exponential that can be done as you get working on this. So, I think that is really an important kind of threshold. That's what I would like to see. Ultimately, we've got to see a change and have the sanctions really bite so that there is this kind of change in calculus. President Obama, back in 2010, I mean, he said that this is really part of his strategy, that using these sanctioning mechanisms is to really change the calculation of the Iranian leadership. And I think that's what the best we can hope for.
Well, as of right now, I mean, that is certainly what the sanctions are supposed to be doing. And what we've got right now is a situation where we've put all of these sanctions in place, and they certainly are hurting the Iranian economy. But now what we've got is sanctions in place and therefore a carrot to use to say, you know, if you do this for us, then we'll remove some of these sanctions and you won't be hurting so badly. I do agree with Jim that I doubt anything is going to get done before the elections. I think everyone wants to know what happens at the elections. But, you know, Ray Takei, who is an expert on the region, has suggested that maybe if we go back to the EU3 strategy of the early 2000s, he says, you know, some kind of Gulf security dialogue could encompass all kinds of issues like navigational rights, a mechanism for addressing border disputes, the prohibition perhaps of certain categories of weapons from the region. I really think that, you know, we're not going to get them to stop by putting more and more and more sanctions on them. I think we've reached sort of the point where we can't sanction them anymore, or at least the marginal returns are not going to go up. They're just going to go down. I think at this point we need to start addressing the problem. And so I'm hopeful that Secretary Kerry can come up with some way of doing that.
In the remaining 5 minutes or so, let's shift to a country that attained nuclear weapons some years ago, despite efforts of the international community, North Korea. And this week, North Korea declared its 1953 Korean armistice nullified, and this amid rising tensions with South Korea, after the United Nations imposed new sanctions as a penalty for the North's third nuclear test on February 12th, the North said it would nullify this armistice and might preemptively attack Washington and Seoul with nuclear weapons. South Korea responded that if there were such attacks, the North Korean government would be, quote, erased from the earth. Give us some context for this escalation, Jim, if you could.
Well, I think there's a couple things going on here. First of all, North Korea has continued to, you know, have these nuclear tests for demonstration effects and kind of prestige. I do think it is part of the new leadership relatively young leadership in North Korea. But I also think it's a challenge to the new South Korean leadership. You know, we just had within the past couple of weeks a new president in South Korea here, a woman president and a daughter of a former actually South Korean dictator here, Park Chung-hee. And so I think part of it is that sort of demonstration effect to show, you know, first of all, that Kim Jong-un is in charge in the North, and then also to challenge the South here a bit in terms of their leadership.
Mm-hmm. Lindsay, go jump in.
I was just going to say, just a little technological context here. North Korea doesn't have the capability to hit Washington, D.C.
Okay.
North Korea barely has the capability to fire its own missiles. They certainly don't have the capability to put a nuclear warhead on a missile. And frankly, if I were them and I didn't know that I could get my missiles off my own territory, I wouldn't put a nuclear warhead on one.
Mm.
They are years away from that capability. They can explode a nuclear device and they can launch a missile. They have not put these two things together yet. They're still a ways away from that. And they have only one missile that's capable of reaching any American territory at all, and it's still in the testing stages. Now, much more of a threat to South Korea and Japan. The likelihood of them launching a nuclear attack against South Korea seems fairly low, since they want South Korea. Seems higher that they would launch against Japan if all they want to do is demonstrate their power. In either case, South Korea or Japan, they know that the United States would retaliate. And I think that, you know, if the United States were to retaliate in a somewhat limited manner, i.e. not by nuking them back, that China would probably just sit there and watch, because China is getting a little tired of North Korea's antics. They're really not interested in backing them up anymore. They don't want the regime to fall, but they don't want it to fall primarily because they don't want a refugee situation, and they don't want basically an entire peninsula of South Korea with U.S. troops on their border. So if we can come up with a compromised situation that China is happy with, then we can all start putting more pressure on North Korea. And that's starting to happen. The one thing we don't want to do is press North Korea into a corner, because then it really might launch, just because it feels like it has no other option.
And in the go ahead, Jim.
What
quickly.
I think needs to be done is, you know, we haven't had any session of the six-party talks. And if Lindsay is right, and I think she is, that the Chinese are, you know, sort of at the end of their rope over the North Korean behavior. Let's have an initiative by the Secretary of State to get China to put pressure on the North Koreans to get into the six-party talks. I mean, I think that the multilateral mechanism is really the way to proceed. We've tried bilateralism with North Korea here. Even within the past year, we thought we struck a deal over, you know, so that they would stop their development efforts, and we in turn give them, I think the number was 250 tons of food. Within a month, that collapsed because of North Korean behavior here. So I think it really has to move in the six-party talk direction that we tried earlier. I mean, I know that those weren't entirely successful, but I think there's more likelihood that we could get a combination of pressure on North Korea. You know, and everything comes through China, frankly, on the North Korean issue.
And finally, we have less than a minute to talk, but we've noted domestically the president has shifted some things from his first term into the beginning of his second term. Can we say that in terms of international politics?
Not sure what you mean.
I think, you know, I mean, one of the things that, you know, if any of this action in the Middle East that I was alluding to earlier, I think what I'm waiting to see is there going to be more emphasis on the Middle East in the second term. There was an attempt early on in the first term of the Obama administration. They sort of dropped it and because it became so intractable. I don't know if they have the option on that, because as I was telling my class, it would be very difficult to be President Obama. I mean, you've got Syria, North Korea, and Iran sort of all bubbling up at the same time. Not a very desirable menu.
Yeah, I don't see him changing trajectory on anything. I mean, I think, you know, I hope Jim is right that President Obama will sort of be a little bit more active in the Middle East. But, you know, he is constrained by reality there. We can't get directly involved in Syria. That is a disaster waiting to happen if we do. There, you know, we definitely want to manipulate the situation if possible, but we don't want to get directly involved. You know, he
quick,
said,
quick, well, we have just a couple seconds if you
okay.
can, Lindsay.
Maybe Asia, the six-party talks, I mean, I totally agree with Jim that would be a good idea to restart. Hopefully President Obama will go that way.
Forgive me, Lindsay Kahn, we've run out of time, but thank you for joining us. Lindsay Kahn of the University of Northern Iowa, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. It's been a pleasure. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton in Ames. We had help from Jason Burns in Cedar Falls, help from Tony Daner. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.